Charles Barkley grew up poor and black in a small town in Alabama. He became rich and famous as a basketball player, one of the best ever to play the game. He's been celebrated and sometimes castigated for his outspoken opinions. After he retired, he became one of the best-known and most popular TV analysts of the game. He's on Turner Sports, and he's also an author. His books include Outrageous, I May Be Wrong, But I Don't Think So, and now a new book about racism in America called Who's Afraid of a Large Black Man? Over 6 months or so, Barkley spoke with a variety of people about an issue he describes as a cancer. People in sports like Tiger Woods, actors like Samuel L. Jackson and George Lopez, politicians Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, minister Jesse Jackson, and Rabbi Stephen Leader. Later in the program, allegations that some of the gurus who review high-tech gadgets on TV took money from the companies involved, and Jim Jeffords announces that he will not run for re-election to the U.S. Senate. But first, Charles Barkley. If you have questions about what it's like to be poor and black, or rich, famous, and black, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Charles Barkley joins us from the studios of member station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hey, thank you, Neil. I'm glad to be here.
I wonder, the first thing just about you write in your book is that racism is a taboo subject, really uncomfortable to discuss. Why did you decide to spend 6 months going around the country and talking about it?
Well, I just wanted to write a positive book on race, Neil, to be honest with you. I think, you know, when you watch television and read the newspaper in America today, it's so slanted one way or the other, which is unfortunate, because very few people benefit from being a Republican or a Democrat or liberal or conservative, but they confuse the masses. And what I hope come out the book is just start an open dialogue and realize we're all just trying to get along together. I think one thing America's done has kept us divided and unequal, and people dislike each other for no apparent reason. And I just want to write a positive book, because whether you're black, white, poor, Hispanic, Jewish, whatever, we're all just trying to get through this thing called life.
Are you angry about racism?
Am I angry? No, I'm not angry about it. I think my ancestors have the right to be angry. I think anybody who grew up in back in time has the right to be angry. But other than being called the N-word a few times, I really can't say race has had a profound effect on my life as far as, in my life. Obviously had a great effect on my history. But I've been called a name a few times. But that just does motivates me to be successful more than anything.
Interesting, reading your interviews with these various people, there does seem to be a difference, an important difference, given how old they are in terms of their experiences with racism.
Yeah, I think so. I think, and that's one of the things I want to, there's things I want to come out the book, and I want young black kids, because really America now is divided more by economics than race, and I want these young black kids, poor white kids, and Hispanic kids to realize they're making their situation worse. I think because of racism, they've got bad neighborhoods and bad schools, but they have compounded the problem with crime, having kids they can't afford, and they've got to draw a line in the sand and say, you know what, we're going to do better. Because I'm not here to bash on the government, but it's obvious to me the government is not going to let their neighborhoods get better. Is not going to let their schools get better.
I think it was Barack Obama who was writing about his experience growing up in Hawaii. He's, of course, the newly elected Democratic senator from the state of Illinois. You talked to him, I guess, about a month before the election?
Yes.
Go ahead.
He is a remarkable person. I had learned a lot about Barack, read about him. Obviously, he was dynamic at the Democratic National Convention. And I just, you know, one thing we're lacking is great black leaders. You think about, to me, my greatest hero of all time of Muhammad Ali, Dr. King, Malcolm X, people like that. But you're hard-pressed to find a great black leader today. And that's not a knock. It's just we don't have any. And I thought Barack would be a great person to lead us, and I'm hoping he does.
There was a comment that, what was it, in the 1960s, Martin Luther King was that great black leader. But after the door has opened a little bit, there can't be just one person. It's got to be a person in medicine, a person in the arts, all kinds of different people.
Well, it's got to, it can't be, you know, I'm not sure how to really to nail the phrase that, because Dr. King fixed everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought Malcolm X did the same thing. I thought Muhammad Ali did the same thing. Well, obviously we're going to have great doctors and lawyers, but there's got to be, I think, especially for minorities, there has to be a face who has our best interest and not their own best interest. And if you look at Dr. King, he had nothing but his people's best interest in this whole thing. I think the same thing with Mecca Evers and Muhammad and all these guys. But really, we don't have a face. You know, I think the greatest, in my opinion, one of the greatest black men in the world today is Colin Powell. But he has chosen to be really not political or outspoken to a certain degree. But I admire him a great deal.
Our number, if you'd like to join our conversation with Charles Barkley, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Let's start with Walter. Walter's calling us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Charles Barkley, how you doing, brother?
Good, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. I'm kind of nervous. This is my first time calling, man, but I just want to admire you, man, because, you know, you got a lot of money and you haven't forgot where you came from. You know, most of our people with money, African-American people, black people, whatever you want to call them, get all this money, forgot where they come from, how they grew up poor, and they don't never come back and help out the people that needs the help. And I just want to, I seen you on this TV show, NBC, man, and I sat down and listened, man. And I just admire you because you speak what's on your mind and you don't care what any political party say, you just speak the truth, Charles. And I just want to say I look up to you, man. And I wish we had more black leaders like that, just to say the truth and don't be afraid of what the backlash is going to be.
Well, number one, I really appreciate him calling in. Man, I'm really blessed in my life. I thank God, knock on wood, every day. And like I heard your little intro coming in about me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people, they go through life that just want to work, make a lot of money, have a big house and a big car. But when you get a special gift, and I think if you play sports, you're given a special gift. You wake up and you're like 30 years old and you got all that accomplished. And then you look at yourself in the mirror and you say, there's got to be more to life than that. And I have made it my goal to, number one, fight racism and fight poverty, because racism it does exist, always going to exist. But like I said earlier, now America is really dictated by poverty. And unfortunately, poor white people, poor black people, Hispanics, they're really in the same boat. But they've been taught not to like each other. And realistically, people who have all the money and the power, they don't live in our neighborhoods. They don't go to our schools. And we have become our own worst enemies by, like I say, killing each other. I mean, black-on-black crime is through the roof. These kids having kids is through the roof. And it really comes down to, they got to do better. And anything I can say or do to help them, I'm going to try. Can't help everybody. But if I get a chance to speak, I'm going to do my thing.
Go ahead, Walter.
You're doing a good job, Mr. Park. I'm going to let you go because I know you got good callers. But, man, you do a good job on TNT also. And just keep up doing the good work, man. And just stay true to yourself. And I see that you are. You stand true that you are black. And just keep on being the best man that you can be, Park, regardless of what everybody and the other society say about you, man. I respect you, brother, man.
Hey, thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Okay, have a nice day, Barkley.
Thanks for
thank
the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
It's interesting. He was talking about, giving back. A couple of athletes, very prominent black athletes, Tiger Woods. Well, he's more than black, of course, and one of the things you go into in the book. But Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan have been
criticized. What's really funny? Let me just ask you that.
Yeah.
You know, people gave Tiger a hard time because, you know, he said he's cobblation.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said was, and we discussed this in the book, and I've disagreed with Tiger at times. I look at Tiger as black. You know, I know he doesn't want to disrespect his mother's heritage, which I respect. His mom is a fantastic person. But as I say, every other black person who got a black dad in the world, no matter what color their mom is, they black. and that's just the truth of the matter.
And if you discuss with your own daughter.
I have. I say everybody who has a black father, in America's eyes, they are considered black. And I know Tiger doesn't want to disrespect his mother's heritage. And I know he wants to be – I wish everybody was neutral when it comes to race because, man, it's just a cancer to be racist. And what I tried to do in the book, I tried to get a black perspective. I tried to get an athletic perspective. I tried to get a Jewish perspective. I tried to get a Hispanic perspective, a white perspective. And then, you know, people say, why did I interview the actors? I said, well, the reason I did Morgan Freeman, Sam Jackson, Ice Cube is because I think television has done a great disservice. Number one, to portray black people. They've done a disservice. They did the same thing with Hispanics. I thought they'd do those guys a disservice. But what I really concerns me is all these young black kids, this is how they think they're supposed to be. They think they're supposed to be thugs and gangsters. They don't think about being doctors and lawyers and firemen and teachers. And that disturbs me greatly. When I watch television, if I was just to watch television, being a young black kid, I would think the only way I could be successful is through music, entertainment, or play sports. I mean, and I feel that when I go out and speak to kids. Because when I'm at a black school, 99.9% of the kids raise their hand saying they want to play sports. And I tell them, you got a better chance of being a doctor or a lawyer than playing sports. But I think television has done a disservice to the way people look at black kids, Hispanic kids in general.
Yeah, interesting. Again, Barack Obama, a tall kid, but he said he should have realized pretty early on that he was not going to be a basketball star.
Well, you know, the thing about Barack says something very interesting because he was talking about when black kids do well in school, other black kids tell them they're acting white, which is absurd and stupid. There's nothing wrong with making good grades. You should make good grades. There's nothing wrong with being articulate. And it really disturbs me when I hear other black kids tell kids who are doing well academically and speech-wise, they're acting white. That's just stupid. That's what they should try to achieve.
Our guest is Charles Barkley. His new book is Who's Afraid of a Large Black Man? It's edited and also has an introduction by Michael Wilbon, the Washington Post columnist. More after the break, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest today is former NBA star Charles Barkley. His latest book is called Who's Afraid of a Large Black Man? If you'd like to speak with us, our phone number is 800-989-8255, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Melanie. Melanie's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. First of all, Mr. Barkley, that's a great title.
Thank you very much, Melanie.
I'm a black woman. I'm 32 years old, so I grew up in the 70s, and I didn't really have to experience a lot of the in-your-face N-word sort of racism. But I find I didn't grow up poor, and I didn't grow up, you know, fabulously wealthy, such as yourself. You know, I'm not wealthy. But I find the racism that I encounter to be sort of a low expectation from white people. Either they praise me for pulling myself out of my up from my bootstraps, which I didn't have to do, or they they come to me for the, you know, what's the hip new thing? You know, I'm a regular old person like anyone else, and I find that lack of respect as the prevailing racism now.
Yeah, I think it is. It's like, number one, they assume that you got somewhere through affirmative action, or you just like, I guess, you know, wow, how did you make it out of there? And I think your point is, well,
my parents sent me to good schools and I thrived.
And I think that's why we really got to raise the expectations of these young black kids, poor white kids, and Hispanics. And the thing I was telling a friend of mine last week is this book has been unbelievable, all the conversations I've had on the radio. And I was telling this guy, I said, you know what's really weird? Every black kid at my high school, we all tried to get a scholarship, but the rest of them never thought about going to college. And I didn't think about that realistically until the last couple of weeks. Like, all the black kids say, we were all trying to get scholarship, but the rest of the black kids never assumed they were going to go to college. And that's one thing I want to do with this book, raise their level of expectations. Because you think about this, and I don't, every white kid just assumed they were going to go to college.
May also be an economic thing. Most of my friends who are my age, who are black, I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Kansas City. Everyone I know, I mean, I was just home for Easter. My friends are lawyers. One teaches at college. One's a doctor. It was just expected of us, but it was also expected of our parents and expected of, to an extent, our grandparents. So I think it starts in the family.
Yeah, no question. And I think that we have done a disservice with all these single parent homes. You know, it's kind of, I'm going to be kind of put this in a, I don't remember any kids, maybe one or two, who had a mom and dad at home. I grew up in a small town in Alabama, and I don't remember anybody having a mom and dad. I know I'm probably missing a couple, but I'm go out on a limb and say, I would say 80%, maybe 90% of the kids I went to high school with who were black were raised by their moms.
Now, hey, I was raised in a single-parent home. I do have to say that my mother did everything she could for me. But my father, I mean, my father was around. And
go ahead.
Wide experience in the black community. And to either put us only in the sort of urban hoop dreams, I only want to go to basketball, you know, play basketball, or the bling bling, I'm a celebrity. There's a wide experience, and we're doing okay.
Well, I think we're not doing as well as we could.
No.
Because we have to really, we're so far behind. You know, the thing about the book is interesting. You know, President Clinton talks about, he said, hey, sometimes you go to a crappy school, you live in a crappy neighborhood, you got a bad mom and dad, but you got to find a way to be successful. And then you go to the other end of the spectrum. And Reb Jackson's a chapter, he says, listen, we've done a disservice to the civil rights movement because this is realistically the greatest time for black people ever to live. But we become so, I'm not sure what the word is, but we get
complacent.
So bogged down or whatever word, complacent, whatever. We have become like, we're not taking advantages of all the sacrifices, I like to use the word heavy lifting that was done in the 60s and 70s by those great people. And we're killing each other at such an enormous rate, it's frightening. We're having kids we cannot afford. And like I say, racism is going to exist, always has, always will, but we have made the problem so much worse by killing each other and having kids we can't afford. But you got to we got to break the cycle somehow.
Melanie, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's go now to Kevin, and Kevin's with us from Minneapolis.
Hi, Charles.
Kevin, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really good.
First off, just wanted to tell you that I've been following a fan of yours since your days at Auburn, and you instantly became my favorite player in the NBA when you entered the league. Because of your obvious talents, but more for being the shortest man in NBA history to win a rebounding title, but mostly became a fan of yours because of your willingness to speak out on the tough issues and to share your opinions on how to make positive changes. Along these lines, you've talked in the past about possible political aspirations. More thoughts on that? And if so, what party would you represent?
Well, I voted for John Kerry because I think that America's really starting to discriminate against poor people. If you look at and the Republican Party, I have been disappointed, number one, how they're really giving benefits to people who are really rich. But also, I think they've taken this religion thing to the extreme.
You once said that you would run for Republican governor of Alabama as a Republican.
No, I never said that. I was having a conversation with a reporter and my grandmother, and politics came up. And my grandmother said, well, we're Democrats. And I said, why? She said, well, because Republicans are only for rich people. I said, well, I'm rich. So people assume I was a Republican. I would run. First of all, neither one of those parties is exactly like bringing no great sunshine on the world, I might add. They're both corrupt. They've sold their souls to special interest groups, which is really unfortunate. Because when you sell your soul to special interest groups, that means you're alienating a huge percentage of the population. But I don't want to go to work and argue with people every day who sold their soul. If you're elected to public office, you're supposed to take care of all the people, That's white, black, rich, poor, Hispanic, Jewish. You're supposed to take care of all the people. You're not supposed to sell your soul to a particular party or a special interest group. And, you know, the governor thing is intriguing, but I think I can do more through charity, through speaking out, because if I were to go to work every day and just argue, I would go crazy. I mean, and it's really unfortunate because the political system in this country right now is so bad. And I thank God every day that I'm not at the mercy of the United States government. And like I say, I don't want to rail on the government. I mean, everybody, like, it's funny, you know, you were teasing on what's coming on next.
Right.
That the people who these companies been paying these people to put good reports out about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really sad to me that somebody would say, I mean, it's really unfortunate.
Well, it's got nothing to do with the government, though.
No, but I'm saying, but that's the way the whole system works.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way the system works. I mean, people are voting certain ways in Congress because they've sold their soul to special interests. And that's not the way it should work. That's supposed to be taking care of all the people. And I would never vote a certain way or say a certain thing because a special interest group paid me to say it. I would never do that. And that's why I'm not sure I want to get involved in politics, because we're supposed to take, because you know, the thing is, I hear these idiots on television and radio all the time talking about they're Democrat, Republican, or liberal or conservative. First of all, there's less than 10% of people in this country who benefit from one of those categories, and they're all rich. They want you to listen to their radio show, or they want you to watch their television show. No, think about it. No real people who actually go into work every single day, busting their hump, who got a family and things like that, they don't benefit for saying they're liberal or conservative. Only a small fraction of people in this country benefit from that. Radio talk show hosts or guys on television, those are the only people who benefit trying to get people to slant one way or the other. Those words don't mean anything to me. Can we have great public schools? Can we have security? Those really the two biggest issues. And can we have jobs? I mean, those really the only three really things that should matter to most people in America, whether they got good schools for their kids, whether they safe in their own neighborhoods, and they got a job. Them really the only two, three things. And like, hey, we're going to disagree on other things, but people deserve those three things, rich people, poor people in this country.
Kevin, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks, Charles. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, man.
Here's an email we get from Leslie Stevens. I strive to erase the racist elements in my upbringing, but I find myself struggling to say and do the right thing. I want to honor black history, but the images I get from the media is that there is a black culture. Is there truly a black culture, and how can non-blacks honor that culture without being racist?
Well, you know, I think there's a difference between race and culture. I think people sometimes confuse the two. I think the young lady, I respect Jewish people. I respect Hispanic people, white people. That's all you can do. Make sure you don't discriminate against another race. You know, it's funny. I told my agent, you know, one thing, we had a very poignant moment in the book.
Mm-hmm.
My agent's a white guy from Alabama. And when you talk about race around white people, they think you're whining all the time, because white people have the luxury. They never have to think about race, because most black people have to ask white people for jobs. And like I say, that's just reality.
Even somebody as rich and powerful as you?
Not me. But I'm an exception. Actually, I still do work for CNN, so my boss is technically a white guy. But I had this very poignant moment in the book with my agent. My agent asked me, "Do you think I'm racist?" I says, "No, I don't." I said, "But you never think about race." He said, "What do you mean?" I says, "Well, think about this. You hired your son, and we've been together for 20 years, and you've only hired white people." And I says, "You're not racist, but if you don't open up opportunity for black people, you might as well be racist." And he got all bent out of shape. And I said, "Just think about what I said. Don't get mad. Just as my girl Judge Judy says, hear me. Don't listen to me. Hear me. There's a difference. And I said, listen, we've been together for 20 years. You've been handling my money for 20 years. I says, you hired your son, and you've hired probably another 15 to 20 people, but you think about it. I've been coming to Smith Barney or Prudential or UBS. He's been at three different companies. And I says, I've never seen another black person in your office. And I say, I'm not upset about it because he's like a father figure to me. But the point that I made was, I said, think about it. You have the luxury of being white. You could go your whole life and never really interact. You go to your neighborhood. I mean, so I just want you to, hey, sometime when a job opens up, you might have to go out of your way to hire a black person. I mean, because trust me, there are some black people qualified, but most white people hire people who look like them or somebody they know. I mean, and that's just reality.
Charles Barkley is the author of Who's Afraid of a Large Black Man. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Brian is with us from St. Louis.
How's it going, Charles?
Very good, my man. How you doing?
Great. Hey, I'm a military recruiter. I've been in the military now for 15 years. And I find it both appalling and embarrassing when you go out to recruit these kids, and the first thing they say is, you're in the white man's army. Or in the army, you guys don't do anything. As they stereotype us as being, us who go in the military, as being of a lower class or uneducated. The military has been a tremendous opportunity for me. You know, in 15 years, I grew up in North St. Louis, very poor family, and now I've done things and been places, and I provide for my family very well, but still and yet there's a stigma attached to those of us who go in the military as if we sold out our community by serving.
Well, first of all, that's just stupid, they thinking that. That's an honorable profession. And I'll be honest with you, I wish more black kids would go into the service. Number one, it gets them out of a lot of bad environments, but also they get an opportunity. You know, I know a lot of the guys go to college and things like that, but to think that going into service is inferior or a sellout, man, there's so much bogus stuff that you have to put up with. See, that's the thing. George Lopez, who's unbelievable in the book, he says, what's really funny to me, when a white guy is successful, gets a big house and move, he's successful. And he was using Oscar De La Hoya as an example. He says, Oscar De La Hoya hits it big, becomes a star, moves, and everybody at home calls him a sellout. And you hear that bogus stuff a lot in the ghetto, too. Which is totally bogus. We all want to do well. We all want to succeed. But unfortunately, you know, sometimes like we said earlier, when a black kid does good in school, we tell him he's acting white, which is absurd. Man, I wish we could get so many more kids to go into the service because they're not doing anything. And I think it number one, you have to have great work ethic to be there. But also, it opens up so many more opportunities for you. And, hey, man, keep recruiting those kids and let them know that it's number one, it's a great profession if they want to make it a profession, but also it's going to open up more opportunities for them. And don't worry about them fools who put you down.
Yeah, I think it was George Lopez says, you know, Donald Trump gets a yacht, he shows it off, everybody's happy for him. But, again, Oscar De La Hoya moves out to Hollywood Hills and people call him a sellout.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's unbelievable.
Brian, go ahead, Brian.
Let me say this, Charles. I really appreciate you because, you know, I've watched the NBA. I grew up watching the NBA. I've seen the replay of the comments you made about Magic Johnson when he had AIDS and all that good stuff and how you admit that it's everybody's right to have their opinion. But, Charles, the thing that I admire most about you is the fact that you have stood up, you voiced your opinions, and even when you've been wrong, you've been able to say, you know what, maybe that wasn't the best decision. And I think that sets a great example in our community. And unlike most stars, Charles, you really put yourself out there on a limb against all odds. Because I'll be honest, I was very surprised to see you on TV as an analyst. Because I thought Charles Barkley, they'll never give Charles Barkley the opportunity to say anything because the guy's just too open. He's too real. But you've done a great job. We really appreciate the work that you're doing. And I thank you for speaking out on these issues because it saddens me as I've grown up here in St. Louis to see I'm watching 28, 30-year-old black men with their pants sagging and braids in their hair, two earrings. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing all in itself, but that's a bad thing at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Brian, thanks very much for the call.
Are we going to break?
Yeah, we got to dump.
Okay, I want to say something when we get back.
All right, Charles, stay with us. We're going to have a short follow-up with Charles Barkley after we get back from a break. We'll also look into news of Republican House Leader Tom DeLay and the Ethics Committee. That's all coming up after the break. I'm Neil Cohn, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In just a moment, high-tech plugola and later a political update. But first, we wanted to finish up our conversation with Charles Barkley, who's the author of a new book, Who's Afraid of a Large Black Man? He's with us from KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Charles, you wanted to follow up on something that was coming up just before the break.
Yeah, my man says something about the way these kids dress today. And I didn't realize this, and we discussed it in Reverend Jackson's chapter. I didn't realize that dress started in prison. Because in prison, you're not allowed to have a belt or shoelaces. And I wish most kids understood this dress code came from prison, and that's no way to dress.
Charles Barkley, thank you so much for joining us today. We do appreciate it.
Hey, thank you all for having me.
And good luck with the book. It's Who's Afraid of a Large Black Man, edited and with an introduction by Michael Wilbon. Charles Barkley is the author.